Happy Tag Tuesday.
Hello.
Hello, I'm Ann Police.
And I'm Denise Cooper.
You are listening to Two Average Girls. Thanks for tuning in.
We love you.
We love you for it. We've got a very special show today, as most of our podcasts are.
Yeah.
We have a recurring guest and we're very excited to have him. But before we introduce him, I feel like this is a safe place, and I feel like this is a good time to talk to Denise about this specific thing.
Uh-oh, are you doing this because of our guest being here?
Our guest is a therapist by trade and training, and he might need to help you work through a couple things.
This can't be good for me. I don't know where we're going with this. We don't ever talk about what we're going to talk about.
Right.
And so this is making me a little anxious and also a little excited.
A little excited? Okay. I have to tell you something that you're not going to like. And I ruin a lot of things for Denise because I've been in television long enough that I kind of know just enough to make myself dangerous.
Also because she's cynical.
I'm very dark. I don't seem it when you first meet me.
I don't think it's dark. You're cynical. That's the difference.
I don't like cynical at all.
You don't?
No.
Okay. What would be better?
I don't know.
What's a better synonym?
Fun.
What's the polar opposite of cynical?
Fun. Fun. I just want to be known as fun with maybe a little bit of an edge.
Okay.
I don't know.
You're edgy.
I guess. I ruin a lot of things for Denise. Sometimes I'll talk about movies that are the worst or actors that I can't stand. And she's like, wait, but I love that
person. You like know, Oprah.
Yeah, Oprah. That's a big problem in our relationship is Oprah. So this is going to cause another problem.
Uh-oh.
I apologize.
Do not tell me Bradley Cooper. You hate him.
Oh, never.
Okay. Brad Pitt?
No. I realized last night as my husband was enjoying this little bit of television.
Uh-huh.
The program F1 Drive to Survive?
Yes.
Hate it.
Okay, this could... John?
aren't we you're in the going, circle of trust?
You're going to have to step in.
I've seen what goes on in her family around F1.
Well, listen, I like F1. I like the racing. I'm all about cars. Dad, both brothers were mechanics, love cars. I'm a car gal. Hod and I, we share that. I love cars. This program is so boring.
What?
And it's scripted television. You
so
know
what?
That. You know it's scripted.
No, it's not. First of all, I met the executive producer, literally sat with him as close as we are sitting in the Paddock Club. He answered questions, and it is absolutely not scripted. It is, however, they do manipulate the way things are edited so that it will be a certain way. Of course, we all know that. They want drama. They want these things.
Right.
Have you watched it from the very beginning?
This is a new season.
Yes, but have you watched the first season?
Yeah, I sat.
Did you watch the first season? The answer is no.
Probably this is why you don't like it. Not as directly as you did.
You have to get into the characters.
No, I am into the characters, but there's a whole...
Have you seen number 55 for Ferrari?
Yeah, I saw him. I mean, yeah, okay.
The Chili Pepper?
He's a, listen.
I'm appalled.
Everybody's beautiful. I get it. Everybody's got their thing. Everybody's very charismatic. I get it.
I mean, it's Red Bull.
It's boring. It's boring.
I haven't seen the new season. We're waiting to watch it because I want to be fully engaged when I watch it.
Yes,
and I usually
yes.
binge it for at least three different episodes
sure.
at a time.
I think it's all on right now.
It is. Yeah. I just haven't been able to get into the mindset of it yet.
Sure.
I mean, we just got done with the old season, literally, because we went to the races
yes.
just in October, November. We just finished it. And they're starting to race like in a couple weeks.
They are.
And yeah. so I'm just, you know, I'm pacing myself.
Okay.
Right now.
Well,
I'm getting into the season. I'm already angry about the season because my driver, who drives for Ferrari, number 55, Carlos Sainz.
Sainz, right.
The Chili Pepper.
The Chili Pepper.
The cutie tootie.
Mm-hmm.
He is not going to be re-signed.
Mm-mm.
They're taking Hamilton.
Yes.
And they're putting him in a Ferrari, which goes against everything I believe.
I saw that. This is how much I was paying attention to the 4, 5, 6 episodes that I...
endured. I cannot believe you're saying these things.
Does this change our relationship?
I'm looking at you in a different light.
Do we need to
We might need therapy.
Do we need to fold John in on this?
We might need therapy.
Sorry.
We could go offline for this.
should we shut it down for a minute, talk it out, and then come back?
Does your husband think it's boring?
He is so into it.
Because he is a smart and amazing man.
And charismatic man who knows what's
right.
He's not cynical. No, he isn't. I bring the cynic.
So what is boring for you?
It's just boring.
It's just scripted. You don't watch Real Housewives or anything either.
No, but I understand with Real Housewives what they're trying to accomplish.
That's scripted for sure.
Oh, it's absolutely scripted. But there was a storyline in one of the episodes that I saw where the kid, he's the child of, what is it, Aston Martin?
Yes, I don't care for him. Okay. Lance Stroll.
He broke both wrists and like a toe or something in his foot from doing something other than racing.
Yes.
So they put him back in the car and it's, you know, I don't know how I'm going to do.
Yeah, yeah, no.
That would be boring for me to watch mentally.
I just fast forward to that one.
Well, it's all part of it.
I know.
How is he any different than the Chili Peppa?
Have you seen the Chili Peppa?
No, I've seen them. They're gorgeous. I get it.
Stroll is not gorgeous.
No, it's all the kind
of thing. And it's also Aston Martin. This is Ferrari we're talking about.
Aston Martin's a gorgeous car, though.
It really is.
It's a gorgeous car.
All the cars are gorgeous. What I love about it is just, I've been there so much now.
Yeah.
And I've walked the paddock. I've been through the whole program. Mm-hmm. It's just like being there. I love it.
I would love to go to an F1 race.
Let's do it.
I'm not against F1. At all. I love it.
You would love the Paddock Club.
I would love all of it.
It's 5-star.
Get me up in there.
It's literally food and drink and VIP and seeing it all and dressing fun and cute.
I'm all for it. Yes, I'm all for it.
It's all about everything we like.
Don't make me sit through the series.
You just aren't a diehard yet.
I guess not.
You're not a diehard. Yet? But you're also cynical, and so I'm not sure if you will ever be. I'm just saying.
I love
you. Don't have to be.
I love a lot of things, Denise.
I know you do. I'm shocked and awed, but you don't like Oprah either, and that shocks and awes me.
It can't.
It does.
We're not going to go into this now.
You also don't like
whom?
The movie that you don't like.
What movie don't I like?
The Christmas movie.
Oh, It's a Wonderful Life. John, would you like to weigh in on It's a Wonderful Life?
No.
Thank you.
Good idea.
No, I don't like It's a Wonderful Life, and I don't like Forrest Gump for the same reasons, because they make me sad.
Okay.
And both my son and my husband
very deep.
Say, no, they shouldn't make you sad. They should make you happy, because they're both stories of hope and overcoming.
They are. Absolutely.
I get so sad in the middle that I don't.
You can't come out of it.
I can't come out of it.
This is why John's here today. We are going to talk talk about some of the family of origin issues that we all have.
We did that last time.
Yeah. We did do that last time. I'm glad you brought that up. John is the second time being here, but last time we did it remotely.
Right.
And so we weren't person to person. Anne is just meeting you for the first time. My experience with you is, you're a psychotherapist by trade, but the way I know you and the relationship that we have is because you are the executive coach for our family and our business. Mm-hmm. And John came to us as a recommendation. I think we went over this before, but he came to us as a recommendation from another family friend who was helping us with finances. And basically, when that friend saw what we were doing, which was making a plan for Generation 2 to take over Generation 1 in our business, he basically said, I won't work with you unless you work with John. And it was kind of like, you either do this or, you know. And so John and we started our relationship not really off in the probably the right. I wasn't seeking John. I wasn't thinking we needed John. I didn't know what I needed or wanted. And I remember the first meeting that we had. I wasn't necessarily a big fan of John.
Who's the cynic now? So, welcome, John.
Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you. When meeting with a family such as the Cooper family, going from generation one to generation two, however Denise said that, do you meet, when she's talking about it and the meetings, whatever, is this a meeting with the entire family? How does that work?
Well, I'm not sure which meeting she's talking about, but the initial one was with her and her husband, the owners of the company, and talking about where they wanted to be in 10 or 15 years, which for most people is extremely difficult to articulate.
It's a long ways off, seemingly.
And when someone presses you to actually articulate that, it can be shocking. But when you ask somebody what makes you happy, and then you stare and wait for the answer, it becomes a very vulnerable moment. Because when we hear ourselves say, articulate what our thoughts are around what is happiness, in a sense, we've made a commitment. So most people don't actually articulate it. They almost talk about happiness in the third person.
Yeah, I can see that. How long has this professional relationship been happening?
We first met in 2013.
It was that long ago?
And we began working professionally in 2017.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's awesome. And one of the reasons we get to talk to John in person is because you were down here working with the family, doing
the last few days
what you do. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily the reason that we wanted to have you on, though, because we did talk about family of origin last time we had you on, touched a little bit on what Denise is saying. But we've been talking a lot lately about the vampires of our lives. Everybody has one, we've learned. At least one. And the more we've talked about it, she has mentioned a few times, John knows all about this. John has lots of stuff he can say about this.
John is the one who first initiated that phrase. Somebody is a vampire.
What does that mean?
Exactly. Let's ask the expert.
Vampire is in my work as a psychotherapist, in my work with children in special education, and I used to work with, used to do group therapy with rival gangs.
Oh, interesting.
And the rival gang, being in a room with rival gangs and working with very dangerous young people, you had to up your game and you had to understand that the world was different. And the criminal mind was, you had to learn the different rules of engagement, if you will. Mm. And they taught me a tremendous amount. And then my work with law enforcement, which has a tremendous amount of vampires in there, and the legal system has a tremendous amount of vampires in there. And then I began to realize, wait a minute, most of these people that cause destruction inside of relationships, inside of families, inside of organizations, inside the community, are very intelligent people. And they're therefore confusing to recognize. Mm. And so in my work with people, I often look to find what metaphor makes sense to them and work inside of their story. When we talk about vampires, we're really talking about, clinically, we're talking about personality disorders. And there's a wide array of different categories of personality disorders. And then there's a wide continuum within each category of a personality disorder. But no one really wants to, like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
But when I began to explain what it was in terms of the metaphor of a vampire, it made sense. And this is how it goes. Back long before the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of diagnosing people for mental disorders, they wrote novels about these individuals, and they're called vampire stories.
Mm-mm. That's true? My mind is blown. That's like, before there was a diagnosis, people were writing fiction.
Fiction
about them.
About them. And if you think about the metaphor of a vampire, a metaphor thrives in the darkness, comes out in dark, is unconcerned about the impact of their behavior on others, puts their victims under spells by putting them in the zone of self-doubt, causing any kind of self-doubt. Double messages, you know, any kind. There's various ways to cause self-doubt in people. And they're averse to two things: the light of day and mirrors. The whole garlic thing, that's, I don't know where that came from. So the metaphor is they thrive on darkness, mm-hmm. and they're averse to looking at themselves, mm. or having insight to see into themselves,
mm-hmm.
And in anything that shines the light on their behavior, exposes them. Mm. And when someone does show the mirror or expose their behavior, shines the light on it, they do one of three behaviors. They're very predictable. And those behaviors are they either attack the person holding the mirror, shining the light, run, or both.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple.
Attack and run.
Or just attack.
Yes.
And just attack.
Right.
But most run. Sure. When you hold up the mirror, that's the important study here. But when it comes to personality disorders or the various types of vampires, it's really important to realize they like to suck the lifeblood out of any relationship, organization, community that's around them. So how you know you're dealing with a vampire is they're predictably exhausting.
Mm.
And that when you go to, you're about to have a staff meeting and you go, oh my God, what are we going to do about, I don't want to go because so-and-so is always going to be there.
Right.
And then all of a sudden they got rid of so-and-so and now everybody likes to go to staff meetings. Shocking.
Or you have a Thanksgiving dinner and there's that one person that you're preparing yourself for.
Uncle Bill.
Mm-hmm. I have an Uncle Bill and he's awesome. So this isn't about our real Uncle Bill. That was just, we've changed the names. But yes, Uncle Bill's going to be there and you're thinking ahead of time, how am I going to approach this? You're gearing up.
How am I going to stay out of drama?
Yeah.
Avoid the inevitable thing that seems to happen no matter what we do. Right. They figure out and everybody walks away either upset, mad, in conflict, or exhausted, or
all of the above.
All of the above.
What motivates a vampire to do that particular behavior? Like, why do they want to upset people? Why do they want to suck the lifeblood, as you said, out of a relationship or a community or a situation? What are they receiving from that?
When you lack a certain insight or awareness of what is the impact of who I am on other people, and you don't really care about that, the more narcissistic type,
mm-hmm.
Is everything in the world is an extension of them. Mm-hmm. If it's the company, if it's the relationship, it's the kid, if it's their dog, it's, you know, everything is, there's no separation, mm-hmm. between them and other. And so it becomes necessary for them to control other, therefore. And so how they control you is through certain levels of intimidation and causing you to doubt your own perception of the world. They will do something and deny they did it. Mm. And you'll go, and you'll just doubt. It's like, wait a minute, I saw that. But he's saying just that little bit of doubt and they're in you.
Right, right. Or famously, turn it on you. Oh, you took that wrong.
Right.
Oh, don't be like that.
Oh, you've met some of these.
Maybe.
Well, and I really want to say we're talking about a very, very complex and very, actually, it's, you know, only 4-6% of the people
Have this kind of personality trait.
Well, are one of the personality disorders, okay? So it's not a large part of the population, but you think about it, you go to church or you go to work or you walk into a restaurant and you go, okay, 4 in 10? That's actually a lot of people.
That's a lot after you've collected all the people in your life.
Particularly when a single one can consume and control a room.
Right.
Or an organization.
Right.
And often when I'm working with executives, I'm helping them weed out clientele that are that, or when they have employees that kind of spike that continuum,
mm-hmm.
how to get them to exit themselves, because this group tends to be highly litigious.
Oh, really?
I think that it, you've talked about it before, but I think it goes to note that when we're talking about a vampire, it's a pretty negative connotation. These people that we're talking about are not necessarily bad.
Evil. They're not.
Or evil. They're not aware. They don't have enough awareness to realize that that is something that we might categorize them as.
Yeah, a small few of are sociopath that have no remorse for having hurt or harmed somebody else. The majority of them are just not malevolent. They just suck the life out of every relationship.
That's why I asked, like, what's the point? Why? What are they getting out of it? Because Denise and I both know people who you watch their behavior and you have to wonder. You don't see this. You don't see how horrible you're being. And what is it that you're getting from this kind of behavior? They're getting something, attention. I don't know.
They're getting psychic food by the drama, the intensity, and a certain type of self-esteem of being important by being able to control the mood of others, the affect of the room. That is a powerful position. Mm-hmm. So they get a sense of self-esteem by being important in various types of ways, because there's, you know, I mean, we could go into different, you know, I mean, like an obsessive compulsive personality disorder, not somebody who likes everything's in, you know, right, in their life. There's a certain type of vampire that literally thinks that they're trying to make the world better for everyone. If everyone would only follow every rule that they want to make, and they focus on the rules rather than, you know, they miss the point of what we're actually trying to accomplish.
Right.
And don't realize that, and they get all worked up over nobody's following their rules. They think if only people would do this, the world would be such a better place.
Yes.
But everybody's exhausted and doesn't show up anymore.
Negative attention. They don't register negative attention versus positive attention. It's just attention, or it's just.
That's a fair way to say it, but it's more like intensity, mm-hmm. positive or negative. That's what they're after.
Intensity.
And it can, and attention is a part of that.
Yes.
But there's nothing, you know, this type of person, when they come to the party, you go, well, was Mary there? Oh, no. You know whether Mary was there. I mean, we've met people, you would think, did they come today? Oh, yeah, she was there. You know, some kind of very quiet people that you don't really know. No, if a vampire's there, you know.
They've left their garlic and moved on.
Maybe that's where the garlic comes from.
Yeah.
I think that when you talk about it, and we, Anne and I have talked a lot about this after you've identified it with our family and in our work atmosphere, and then you always bring everything home, right? And especially in a family business. The business of family and the family business are very integral with one another. It's almost like you can't distinguish the two. They're one and the same. But then you start bringing some of what you teach us about how to manage our business, and you bring it into the family units and the family of origin and then the extended family. It's very hard in a lot of families, and I can speak for my own, but also I've seen on the peripheral for other people, it's very hard to distinguish some of these characteristics or even to identify a vampire, because it's something that's always been, right? It's not anything different. I mean, we've all lived with Uncle Bill for the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. That's just how he is. And guess what? There's probably one of his offspring that have also taken on these traits because they've learned that it works for Uncle Bill and now it works for them. You were asking, what is it that they're gaining?
Yeah.
Part of it is that it works.
Well, that's the thing. People, like you said, you know when they've been at a party or you know when they've been in a situation.
They're in the room.
They're in the room, but people are running for cover.
Everyone's having, may not be running for cover, but everyone's doing some version of adapting to them.
Yes.
Making them the center of what's happening. They have to be managed before we can get on with business. And what a vampire does is you become an extension of them in order to keep peace. Mm. And over time, in order to keep peace, you have to lose your sense of self. And this is what happens in many domestic violence situations, mm, where they do not, they, in order to survive, they don't even know who they are unless they are led or told. Often this is why they, sometimes why they return to an abuser so many times.
Yeah, I get that. I can see that.
Can you give us an example in a family situation of a vampire?
Okay, so again, I want to remind us that we're dealing with a severe diagnostic. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is rare, and the mistake that we can make is that, you know, I get worn out by Thanksgiving, mm-hmm, therefore my families are full of vampires. That's not what we're talking about.
Right.
That is not what we're talking about. Well, let me say it this way: one of the fastest ways to diagnose a when I would work with a family, to diagnose that there's a vampire in there, is that everybody around the vampire is angry. And often everybody else is losing control of their behavior. The healthy ones are going, what the heck? Stop it. And they're made to look the fool. So one of the common characteristics of a family system with a vampire is everyone's angry and they don't know why. Because they're being set up with self-doubt, double messages. You know, you didn't see what just happened.
Yeah, gaslighting.
Yes, all that.
All of that.
And it's not, these are not one-off. These are patterns that go on. And everyone either agrees to just suck it up and adapt to it over time, or it blows up. And often the one who lights the fire is not the problem.
I would imagine that the characteristics of a vampire, there would also be a complication. Number one, you've talked about mental health, uh-huh, right? There's depression, possibly. There's bipolar, whatever there is. There's all kinds of diagnostics.
And there's a continuum. So, and some only kind of go over the line under high stress. Others live there. One of the points I would want to remind us of is that vampires are often, more often than not, highly functioning.
Yeah, that's a good point, because we've talked about this before. You're expecting that you'll walk into a room and you'll know who that vampire is, because yeah, they'll look a certain way.
It's not drunk Aunt Sue who's sitting in the corner with
no,
her martini.
Oh, no.
That's not who it is.
They're much more slick, smart, conniving,
yeah,
and self-serving. And because of that, they often rise to places of authority.
Sure.
Oh.
Like the surgeon, the lawyer.
The politician.
The politician. Absolutely the politician.
They're all vampires.
And lawyers. Mm-hmm. School teachers can spike in one of the vampire types.
Really?
Because they have to be in control?
No, because they get to be in control.
I mean, as a teacher, absolutely. That's 100%. You have 28 students and you are controlling them. I've got my grade book. Mm-hmm. I've got my... I get to say how this is going to turn out for you. I get that. And I'm not even a vampire.
How do you know?
Well,
we know.
That was the other question. If people are listening, and you know, it's really funny because a lot of times you'll listen to self-help things and you're like, yeah, so-and-so really needs this.
Right. And it might be you.
It might be you. Is there a way that someone could tell if they are a vampire? Is there a test we could take?
Okay, well, we'll go back to the definition of a vampire.
Okay.
They're averse to mirrors.
Okay.
Vampires don't go to psychotherapy.
Mm.
They run from psychotherapy, because what is psychotherapy? A mirror. And so vampires tend to not ask, is there something wrong with me? No, they're always saying, there's something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. They can't look at the mirror. So I think you're getting to another point, is how do we really know if we suspect? Well, there are, I developed five rules of engagement.
Let's hear them. Mm-hmm. I want to hear all five.
Well, I will give them to you.
She's going to write them down.
Ready to go.
I think she wants them now.
I do. I'm sorry. The vampire in my life is so prevalent.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you these rules of engagement as a way to fully diagnose the situation. If you wonder, is this really what's going on? One way to do is to engage them in this way and see what happens. The other is that if you're pretty sure you're dealing with someone who lacks insight, is averse to being addressed with, hey, what you did was inappropriate, that's holding up the mirror or shining the light. And that they're sucking the life, you're just exhausted, or you're always angry and you don't know why. Could be you're dealing with the vampire. One way to ascertain if it's true is to begin using these rules of engagement. These rules of engagement are about controlling affect.
Explain affect.
Well, affect is when I talk to you about something really exciting, it's you hear the excitement in not my words, but the tone and the language structure or the language pattern. That's the affect. It's emotion, but it's also all of the messages and values behind it. So it's an affect. And so what a vampire tries to do is control your affect. Mm. Put you to sleep. Put you under a spell. When you are under a spell, they are controlling your affect. They're playing you like a puppet. They can get you upset. They can get you sad. They can make you happy. But it's almost like the spell of it. You're almost asking for permission to feel something. That's the extreme.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, everything they do is determined on affect. And when they can predict your affect, their worst parts will come out to play. When a gang member can predict your affect and can knows that you what you will do, that's when they get take advantage of you.
So fear, like when you're talking about a gang member.
Fear.
I assume that's what it's based in.
Fear. So exactly, with a gang member, what they taught me early on was you don't stare them down, but you never look away. Because if you look away, whoop, beacon, victim, whoop, over here. But it's this balance of looking at them longer, not a stare down, but just enough to know, I got you. I'm not asleep over here. That's all it is.
Okay.
They're looking for people who are ready to go to sleep, go under a spell. And a vampire can spot that person a mile away. It's kind of the example of why certain people get, and we'll talk about women, use women for example, get abused over and over. Some women get abused over and over again, and some never do.
Right.
Why is that? Yeah. They have a beacon on that says they're willing to give up their affect. Healing women from abuse is actually teaching them to turn off the beacon of victim.
It's so terrifying because it's all subconscious for the victim as well as the vampire. It's all on a different level.
Yeah, but the vampire knows consciously what they're doing.
I'm going to give the people that I know that I think are vampires the benefit of the doubt to say that they might know what they're doing, but they're subconsciously doing it, or are they doing it on purpose? Like, are they going there to get it, to get that, or do they not even realize that that's what they're doing?
Well, some of them can convince themselves that what they're doing is normal and kind and wonderful, and they're just trying to help the world. But the extreme vampires, the really dangerous ones that are violent, mm-hmm. you know, they're malicious and they know they are.
Yes.
And they have.
And they're okay with it.
They're okay with that. That's just kind of like how's the way the world rocks for them.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But again, back to affect.
Yeah.
So these rules of engagement is kind of the flipping the, you know, it's you controlling the affect rather than letting the vampire control the affect.
So,
or who you might think is a personality disorder.
How do I then, as the would-be victim, you're the vampire, you're coming at me with something very animated or whatever. How do I control the affect?
First of all, I'm going to give you rules of engagements for a vampire. Uh-huh. And before I do that, I would like to remind us, if you have to do these in any relationship, mm-hmm. in order to survive, that's not a good relationship. That's not doing relationship. Okay, but this will work with vampires.
Okay.
But whether they're violent or they're just...
Passive-aggressive?
Passive or just kind of oblivious narcissist that, you know, wouldn't really hurt anybody, but they're hurting everybody, you know. So, rule number one, never raise your voice.
As the non-vampire.
Correct.
I'm not raising my voice.
Never raise the voice.
Okay.
Number two, remember affect here.
Yep.
Okay. Number two, never swear or name call.
You're such a jerk.
That's it. No, do that. No, no, Don't no, no. Off limits.
Okay. But...
Okay.
Go on. No, go on.
Never express anger.
Okay. But they're telling me something that they know is going to make me angry.
Mm-hmm.
You know I lifted $200 from your purse.
Okay. Yeah. But remember, we're trying to control affect. Okay. If this is an appropriate rules of engagement in a relationship and it's, you know, you don't want to be in a relationship where this works. I'm telling you.
Right. But sometimes we don't have a choice because that person is our parent. So when a parent comes to you and says, you know, your husband really made me mad because he didn't give me everything I wanted. And I need to look away, not look away, but
not raise your voice.
Not raise my voice.
It's all about affect. So raising your voice is giving them affect cues.
That's right.
Swearing or name calling is giving them affect cues.
Okay.
Expressing anger. Obviously, it's an affect cue.
Right.
Number four,
yep.
Speak in zero affect.
Okay.
I'll explain that in a minute.
Okay.
I'll come back to demonstrate that. Number five is always postpone decisions, even when you know the answer. Controlling affect. So what is speak in zero affect? I'll give you an example of that.
Okay.
I just got back from visiting my grandson, which is my first, probably my only grandson, and it's my son's son. And even though we have had struggles, my son and me, there has been a healing of glorious kind between my son and myself because of my new grandson, Jasper.
That's an example of zero affect.
That's an example of zero affect. One way of saying it is you're slowing your speech pattern and you're placing commas where commas don't belong.
Yes.
And the point is they can't read your affect. And why do we want them to? Why are we wanting to control affect? Here's why. When the best way to control a vampire is if they control their own behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to get them to control their own behavior is when they can't predict your affect.
Mm-hmm.
When they can predict your affect, they will misbehave. If they can't, they will put boundaries and limits on themselves. That's the best outcome with a vampire is they put limits on themselves because our limits are something that they like to play with.
Well, that's the thing. Our limits are anger, name calling, yelling.
Well, in a normal relationship, yes, they would be.
They would be. And so they're getting everything they want from it. So you have to turn that on its head and go, no, I have to do just the opposite when this person comes with me with their complaint about my husband. And what are you going to do about it?
Right.
I'm not going to do anything about it right now. Yeah.
John gave an example before to me about through this kind of idea. And he was talking about a circumstance where somebody is very animated. They want to see your reaction. And the best way to do it, and I've had to practice it because I speak fast anyway.
Yeah. No, no.
Dee Dee.
And I have a lot of affect.
A lot of affect over here.
I go big,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Like I'm very animated.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're dealing with these types of people, I've had to literally practice it so I can be prepared. And like John said, when you're dealing with this or you're trying to figure out if this person is a vampire, you have to kind of go to an extreme. He even has told me, you will speak in a tone and in a pattern that is very slow this person because you want them to know that this is a different kind of conversation.
Oh, so you're like establishing a break in this, like, pay attention to how I'm saying this because this is where it ends for you. This is where you, as the vampire, need to check yourself.
We need to see if they actually notice.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're just a person that's had some troubled life and they've been behaving badly and we mistakenly thought they were a vampire, they're going to look at these things you're doing going, come on. And they're not going to go ugly on you. They're going to go, what? Okay. Normally you would recognize that isn't normal.
People would be like, why are you talking so slow? What's going on here?
But a vampire tends to run and doesn't know what to do. They freeze. They put limits on their behavior. If that's the impact of these rules, you just check the diagnostic boxes mm-hmm. of a vampire. And the last one, the fifth one, of which was always postpone decisions, even if you know the answer. Why is that affect?
Yeah. Why is
good
that?
Good question.
Because often many of the different types of, not all of them, many of them will make everything a crisis and they'll call, oh, I got to do this. I got to do it again. You got to call me right. They try to control you and put you in a double bind because they want to make everything a crisis.
Right.
They want to, and they tend to wait to the last minute or make you think it's the last minute and that it's your problem that they're in crisis. And that's why you always go to, well, let me think about that. Or you ask them to always leave a message.
You don't ever pick up the phone.
You don't pick up the phone. You leave them, you don't pick up the phone. And if they text you, you don't answer the text till tomorrow.
Right.
I know that that drives them crazy.
And when it does, now, a lot of people, let's be fair. Right. Many of us are like, okay, let me just ask them. And it's
exactly.
Like, what? It's been 2 minutes. They haven't responded.
Exactly.
You know, it's still got to be in context of you're trying to establish whether this is a severe mental illness or not.
Right.
And, if it really puts them on their heels, meaning back them up, they're setting limits with themselves. Check.
Well, but also a lot of times with the vampire, when you don't get their urgency, when you don't understand their crisis, they get mad. And then it raises the temperature of their conversation with you.
Right. And that's another ploy of theirs is they get angry. They start name calling. They start breaking these rules.
Right.
And that's when it becomes more important for you to drop down even farther.
Oh, it's so maddening, though, to the vampire when you do that.
I know. It's so satisfying to you, though, when you see
it. If it is maddening, that means you have one.
Mm-hmm.
Normal people would go, I'm sorry. Am I being a jerk now?
Right. Here's what I've always thought, and back me up in my wrongness, because I know I'm wrong. There's all these, I'm thinking of when your fourth grader came home and was doing bubble maps and they all kind of converge in one thing, that people with various mental illnesses or personality disorders, that in the center of all that, where they all converge, is being a vampire. And that's not true.
No, this is outliers.
Okay, so it's outside the bubble map, really. It's not the interior.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
But because we're dealing with 4-6%, have some version of this.
Yeah.
Any group you're involved with or any family, guess what the odds are?
You're going to find one.
You're going to find a few, maybe.
Yes.
Right.
And
they inordinately control the energy, the mood, the power, the direction of things. And one has to be discerning about that great leader who really moves us.
Yeah.
versus that leader who takes us off the cliff.
Do vampires like to be around other vampires? Do they congregate with one another, or do they avoid? Because, you know, Dracula was kind of a singular kind of figure. He's a loner. Are their personalities the kind that they want to be the person? They're the one.
Okay. The trap here is to think that all vampires are the same.
Okay. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's why it gets so tricky.
There's many personality disorders, and which are severe mental illnesses, not to be confused with stupid or not functional. They're highly functional people, but there's also a continuum within each one of those personality disorders. And there's always the stress effect that somebody's functioning well enough, but you add enough stress and they kind of drop into the kind of the vampire zone. They'll pop back out. Mm. And so it's squishy.
Is that a technical term?
Yeah.
It's not a hard line. I get what you're saying. Yeah. It's not necessarily a hard line for all of them.
And that's why we're always confused by, sometimes they're, even if they're clearly diagnostically personality disorder, sometimes they're fine. But that's part of their gig.
Mm-hmm. What do you say, or how do you counsel somebody who has experienced living with a vampire, through a vampire, because they're a parent or they're a close family member all of their life, and then that vampire is no longer, they pass away. There's no resolve to this. You know, you're giving us tools now, and we're thinking, okay, now next time at the family dinner or next time at the, you know, the company party, I'm going to use this skill. I'm going to try this. Or if I get engaged with one of these vampires, I'm going to learn to slow my speech. I'm going to have zero affect. I'm not going to engage in the name calling. I'm going to rise above. But when people don't have that kind of closure, how do you deal with it after you've lived it for so long?
Well, we'll talk about my wife's mother,
mm-hmm.
who was a harmless narcissist, but caused great harm
mm-hmm.
by making the whole world about her. It was, they didn't know what they were dealing, and they grew up in poverty, so they didn't have a lot of resources to, you sure. know, and so they didn't know, and she lived in a trailer in one of the sister's backyards, and my brother-in-law thought he was, and he was, doing the honorable thing, taking care of the elders. Well, there was a high cost to having a narcissist live in the backyard to the grandchildren. And, you know, to the grandchildren. Oh. So there was a high cost. But, and when my wife and I got married, and I had to inform them, excuse me, but she's a harmless narcissist causing harm. She's not mean.
How did that go over?
They finally were able to find relief, going, oh, this really is a mental illness. Then she passed away. And when the sisters, there were five of them,
mm-hmm.
got together, one of the things that they didn't realize, but they all, when she died, do you know what the song they sang and didn't want to tell each other?
Mm. Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead.
Exactly.
No.
No.
Yes.
So all five of them separately having the same experience.
Same experience. Aww. But Denise is asking the question, how do you heal from that?
Right.
Well, the sisters, even though they weren't particularly close, because they couldn't be, because
a narcissist doesn't allow that.
No, nobody else can have relationships. Mm-hmm. It's only, but over the next 10 years, when they would get together, and process, oh my God, mm-hmm. can you believe what oh my God, that really.
So the processing came by a shared experience that they got to have.
Yeah. And so the debrief, mm-hmm. The best is if you can debrief, but sometimes there's no place to debrief or process that. The one thing I would want to leave us with is the question that is asked is, well, how, you know, can we fix this? Mm. Can they be healed?
the vampire?
Yeah.
Okay. Can they?
Well,
you have to drive a stake through their heart.
Back before DSM, when we shifted from DSM-4 to DSM 3 to 4, I think it was. They put them in Axis 2, which meant that Axis 1 are the disorders, you know, depression and anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder, even bipolar and schizophrenia, are Axis 1 because they're amendable to treatment.
Oh.
Okay.
Yes.
Axis 2 disorders are all the personality disorders, are not amendable to treatment. It's not that we don't treat them. It's that the treatment protocols are about boundaries and limits rather than return to higher level of functioning. Mm-hmm. And then they did, you know, DSM-5, a kinder, gentler, and they didn't want to say that they're not healable.
Mm, but they're not.
Well, I actually say they are. And my experience is this. It is healable, but it takes 3 generations.
Ooh, that's a long time.
3.
That's only if you diagnose it or can identify it. Yeah.
And people get help.
And people get help and you set your boundaries.
So let's just example-wise. So,
let's go this way.
Go.
Why it's a 3rd generation. So vampire generation 1, you know, their children tend to not be vampires, but they tend to be traumatized.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. By it. So right. they shifted from Axis 2 to Axis 1 in the old way. They don't mm-hmm. have that anymore, but I still do.
Sure.
And then the traumatized parents, G2, raise kids with just a little bit of anxiety quirky because they had a PTSD parent.
Okay. Oh, I got you.
Okay. Yeah. So they're just a little... Got a little skitsy going on already, but they're, sure. You know, they're fine, you touch. Know, but they're just like, you know, watch out for mom, you know, and so, but then their children, so we go to generation 4.
Oh no.
Their parents just were kind of, every now and then would just be goofy.
Okay.
But that's assuming everybody got some help, yeah. Another other bad things didn't happen, but again, so it's has much to do with getting distance. The healing is getting distance from a vampire and distance from unfortunate life situations, and none of that is guaranteed.
Sure.
I think just talking about these types of personalities, these types of not even disorders, but just we all go through this, right? We all meet the person that, vampire or not, they're difficult. Or our personalities don't jive.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Or Uncle Bill is causing a lot of problems. He's depressed. He drinks too much. And his wife just left him. I mean, there's all these things that happen in life that is because it's messy and scary and all these things. I think just talking about it and giving people the permission to understand that it's not just them. And that you can control some of your experiences in relationships by controlling who you are and how you show up.
Correct.
Right? You have a definite idea that controlling your affect, not even just with a vampire, but with people with a lot of personality disorders, really comes in handy. Yeah.
And so there was two early warning signals that I learned as a psychotherapist when I was doing that alerted me to there's a vampire here. One is I'm angry. And I don't know why. Why am I angry at a person I just met?
Hmm.
Okay.
Mm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That, like, whoa. The other is if I start to doubt my own intelligence. Mm. I'm not saying I'm Mr. Smart, but there's this, they tend to cause self-doubt as fast as possible with anyone they meet in order to put you on your heels and question yourself. That's where the spells start. And so when I found myself getting like, what? Mm-hmm. And then I'm going, wait a minute. Am I not? What? Just doubting myself. And even that's when I would start going down this whole other diagnostic tree.
What about with a vampire? Mm-hmm. Some people are victim to the vampire. And that vampire then doesn't necessarily prey on everybody in the room.
Nope.
They prey on certain people.
Yes. Correct. The ones with that have the beacon that says, I'm willing to go under your spell.
What if you're not willing to go and what if you're consciously saying, I'm not going under his or her spell or whatever, but is there like a learned behavior on that
They
part?
Spot you a mile away and you never see them.
It's so strange because we know a circumstance where this has happened and it continues to go on, because that person becomes the victim because they're open to these types of people and their personality.
I hear what you're saying, and but at the same time, with the vampire in my life, I'm not willing to, I don't want any part of it. Why do they keep coming at me is, I guess, the question. Like, what do they need from me? Even though I'm just like, we're not doing this anymore, they're still coming at me. And I think that's a lot of the vampire behavior.
Right. I would suggest maybe you look at the five rules of engagement and how are you employing all of them?
Right. It's hard. It's hard to change, you know, when you've had someone in your life as long as I have, that all of a sudden we're going to switch gears here now. And I have to remember all five of these things and go over my checklist every time I'm in the same room with this person. You know, it's very difficult.
Right. So if you're not doing those five, they're getting other messages from you.
Right.
They're getting you green lights. They're getting green lights.
Right. Your beacon is on.
I've got to turn off my beacon.
The beacon's got to go.
It's got to go.
We don't need a beacon.
And I will come back to the question you asked is do vampires huddle together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that question. Do they?
Because I want to know, do I need, how many garlics do I need? How many mirrors?
My experience is they're like oil and water with each other. And
there's not enough room for everybody?
No, they escalate each other, and it becomes like a wolf pack. Who's the alpha vampire?
Like, so we could basically say, I think of our circumstance. I think of the vampire as being an alpha and also being a bully.
Is an alpha a bully, or are they mutually inclusive?
Vampires are not all bullies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. That's true.
That's interesting.
My experience is different.
Because you think I'd be...
Or all bullies aren't... And so all bullies aren't vampires. Vampires.
Exactly. Exactly. So you're not going to see a litter of vampires chilling at the bar. They aren't getting what they want from one another at all because they see themselves in the other.
And again, I want to remind your listeners that what we're talking about is a severe mental disorder, and we're throwing around a metaphor.
Yeah.
But they literally, they've written stories about these, and they're in fairy tales too.
Yeah.
So it's a real thing. It's a human condition. It's a severe mental disorder, and we're not wanting to be playful.
No.
But it's not every difficult person in your life either.
It can't be.
No.
It can't be. So when you identify the vampire in your life, and I'm not saying everybody has one, but Denise and I, one of the things we have bonded over the years is identifying the vampire in our lives. Having said that, and you said earlier, if that's a relationship that you're in, you need to get out of that relationship. What if that's not an option?
That's right. Often it's not.
Mm-hmm. What do you do? Do you, as the victim, go get counseling?
Yes. It's very much like Al-Anon. In that, you know, you can't control the addict, but it's impacting you, and there are some patterns that you need to understand that you are part of the problem.
Sure, with your reactions.
And with your way of being or whatever it is, and that you can be healthy even if you can't completely free yourself from the addict. Mm-hmm. Same is true with vampires, unless they're violent. But again, that's often the most difficult vampire to get away from.
Sure, I can see that. It's impossible. Yeah.
Do you think that women are more likely to be victims of vampire than men?
Yes.
Are vampires usually one gender or the other? Do you see more?
Sociopathic, or what they call antisocial personality disorders, tend to be more male. Borderline tend to be more female. Narcissists are the kind of equal. My experience with a obsessive compulsive personality disorder is more male.
Okay. Interesting. So all over the board, really.
It's all over the board.
Yeah. Is there a correlation between addiction be it alcohol, pills, prescription drugs, and the vampire personality? Is there any correlation?
No. More correlation to victims of vampires to addiction than
the vampire being addicted.
So you're saying that people who maybe are addicted could be more of a victim to a vampire?
Right. Or you
It's one of their strategies to survive.
Mm-hmm. Or you're numbing yourself out because you can't deal with the vampire.
Or
you can't get away from
it. Or you're clinically depressed as a result, and now addiction is clinical depression is, addiction is almost always secondary to some form of clinical depression. It's a very, just a reminder to your listeners that it's a severe mental illness. It's more rare than common. Mm. And just because somebody is hard to get along with doesn't make them a vampire.
Right.
The key thing is, if you're wondering, are you angry and you don't really know why? Are you angry
around this person
and you can't really, and do you doubt your own perceptions, doubt yourself in any way when you're around this person? Mm-hmm. You put those two together, you probably need to put the 5 rules of engagement into
place. So when the thing comes up and you're at Thanksgiving dinner and you just put them in their place, do all those 5 things, and they start crying and go to their room, That's running. Because they didn't get what they wanted from the situation.
They're getting really uncomfortable and scared.
Do you ever suggest, when you've got someone like that in your circle, if this is a person that you kind of can't get rid of, but maybe it's a little more peripheral than it is, you know, a husband and wife or something of that nature, do you ever say to people, maybe you should encourage that person to get into therapy, the vampire themselves? How does that kind of go? Would you suggest that?
Yes, but they never go.
It's not their problem.
And it's almost diagnostic.
What do you mean?
If those other 5 engagements work, rules of engagement work, and you ask them to go to therapy and they won't, it's just kind of like another layer, another check mark.
That's 6. That's the 6th thing. Yeah. So, okay.
You can't control them.
No, I know that. I know that. But there are varying degrees of vampirism.
Absolutely.
And so there are some people who might just be, like you said, sort of on the edge of it, or maybe it's situational. And those are the type of people that I would think you could kind of pull aside and go, listen, Auntie Jane, you don't seem to be doing well when XYZ happens. Have you ever thought about therapy?
Right. Well, the problem with psychotherapy is a lot of time it doesn't work.
What? What do you mean? Why? Why wouldn't it work?
In my career, my work was, and I told people straight up, is my job is for you to not come to therapy.
Yeah, please.
If therapy goes on and on and on, there's something wrong, and usually it's the therapist. And I've worked with therapists in my profession. It took me probably 12, somewhere between 12 and 15 years in clinical practice to be able to quickly spot a personality disorder.
Mm.
Most therapists aren't, and it was working with gang members that gave me these distinctions.
Wow.
And police. And so many therapists don't have the training, experience, or the guts to call a spade a spade.
Hmm.
And because early on in an assessment process, if you think you've got a vampire, a personality disorder, there's a completely different protocol of engagement. And if you go down the wrong protocol, you're going to be perpetuating the problem.
Really?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's terrifying as a professional, as a therapist. It's
a very difficult disorder to spot quickly. And so the two of you are talking about, oh yeah, this relationship we've had, I've known them for 20 years and it's always been a problem. Right. Try to figure that out in 2 sessions.
Once a week. Yeah.
Especially when people go to therapy, and I've been to therapy when I've gone to therapy, I usually go because I'm desperate. I need something. A lot of people are going because somebody else suggested it, or they gave them an ultimatum, or they're being made to do it. I don't know if people bring their true self to therapy and really uncover who they are.
If that's the reason they're there.
Yeah, and especially if you're a narcissist and you're a vampire, you can manipulate a situation pretty well.
Completely.
And like you said, if he doesn't have the experience, or they don't have the understanding or the know-how, or even really, I mean, sometimes it's gut.
Well, you have to confront a personality disorder very quickly to see what they're made of. Mm. And most therapists are afraid to destroy the trust and therapeutic relationship by coming on too strong too quick. And, you know, that was the benefit of being a male therapist versus a female therapist, you know, because, you know, if I'm being aggressive, I'm just being a guy. If she's being aggressive, she's a bitch.
Mm. When you say confront a personality disorder, what, give me an example. What do you mean?
I challenge them. I say no to them. I hold up the mirror. Mm. You said this, right? What did that mean? Is this true?
And then they either disappear and you never see them again.
Most of the time they do.
Is that right?
That's what happens.
That's what happens.
But see, if they stayed in treatment, I'm at risk of being sued.
Why?
Because they're very litigious.
With suing you for what, though? Give me an example.
Like... all kinds of things. See, in the world of lawsuits, it doesn't have to be true.
No, it doesn't. No. Well, please.
And in terms of licensure, it doesn't have to be true.
What a horrible position to be in, where you're trying to help someone and at the same time you've got this one foot out the door of, I can't go too far.
Right. And that's where employers are at a lot of the time. And when I'm working with companies and I'm working with family businesses, you know, one of the things that can be truly vulnerable is their HR.
Again, we're not trying to simplify a very, very deep and serious problem. What we were trying to do is bring light to our audience so that they could possibly handle something on their own, so that they could set boundaries for themselves and they could have healthier, happier, better relationships with those around them at work, at home, wherever. So thank you for coming.
We appreciate you.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you. Nice to see you.
No, nice to see you. Thank you so much. I'm Ann Police.
And I'm Denise Cooper.
We're Two Average Girls. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Two Average Girls. Episodes of Two Average Girls are free wherever you get your podcasts.
Be sure to hit the follow or subscribe button on the Two Average Girls main page so you never have to go searching for new episodes.
Our editor is Aiden Bloomstein.
Our social media producer is Samantha Stone.
And original music for Two Average Girls is by Jason Fries.